All the best Bitcoin works read aloud so that you can listen. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, and we are doing some reading about Bitcoin. Well, actually, not about Bitcoin. We're kind of walking through some internet history and talking about where decentralization and decentralized protocols thrive and what pushes them back to the fringes of society, what makes them essentially lose their luster. Why does it not take over, essentially? And we've seen this numerous times through the history of the internet now, and we've got examples to kind of explore. The author we're reading from today is Brandon Arvanaghi, and he's not a like Bitcoin only guy, so you might not have heard of him, but this is just a really good article, and I agree with a lot of what goes on here, and I disagree with some of it too, but I think it's going to lead to a really fun discussion, and there's some really, really great points in this. So let's go ahead and jump into our read, and then we'll get Guy's take afterward. Again, it's written by Brandon Arvanaghi. I'll have the link to the article and his Twitter in the show notes, and it's titled, How Decentralization Dies, The Killer Concessions. Decentralization has never been an end state. In hindsight, it has always been a vessel for achieving a concession from a centralized body it is protesting. Every decentralization play has followed a simple pattern. Protest a market inefficiency, win that protest via a major concession, and then disappear back to the fringes of society. You can see this throughout history. Music. From 1999 to 2008. Quote, if you want to legitimately pay for downloadable music, you need to access dozens of websites using a variety of different programs that may or may not be compatible with your hardware, and there's a good chance that what you want isn't even available. On the other hand, if you pay nothing, you can find whatever you want in a heartbeat. This isn't the world I want to leave to my grandchildren. But if the many players of the recording industry don't get their act together, it's what they'll get. End quote. Bill Barnes, Slate Magazine, 2002. The Problem, from 1999 to 2002. Major record labels did not make popular music available online. When they did, it spanned across multiple different sites and formats. The Protests. Napster, an application with a library of all music in MP3 format. The Nutella Protocol, behind LimeWire and its derivations. BitTorrent. The Concessions. Record labels agreeing to 99-cent music on the iTunes Music Store. Freemium licensing model behind Spotify. Online music had a tumultuous road to what I call its steady-state product-market fit. A paid subscription to stream any song you want from a single service. The MP3 file was a revolution, and it was how the world wanted to access music in the late 1990s through the early 2000s. It was lightweight, supported by multiple clients, and easy to copy across devices. Record labels had not gotten their acts together to find a reasonable, user-friendly way to provide customers music by top artists online. This market inefficiency bore the protest called Napster in 1999. By 1999, Napster had 150,000 registered users trading 3.5 million files. By 2000, an even more resilient decentralized protocol called Nutella was born, giving birth to popular peer-to-peer applications like LimeWire. By 2001, Bram Cohen invented BitTorrent, an even more decentralized way to download files, and Napster had 60 million registered users. The centralized world tried to respond to this sudden uptick by having a legal alternative. In 2000, MP3.com released my.mp3.com, a service that would let you legally stream songs after you could prove possession of a CD containing that song by inserting it into your computer. Even this was unacceptable. Universal Music Group, EMI, Warner Brothers, BMG, and Sony banded together under the RIAA and successfully sued MP3.com in 2000 for what the court deemed was not fair use of the copyrighted materials. MP3.com settled for $54 million, which led to their share price plummeting and eventually the discontinuation of their service. But Napster was worse than MP3.com for the record labels. It was built on a peer-to-peer network, meaning these MP3 files lived on computers from regular people across the world. This made it easy for record labels to come after the company of Napster for helping people find these songs, but difficult and soon impossible to actually cut off access to the millions of computers actively sharing these songs on the underlying network. In laying the groundwork for a resilient, decentralized protocol, Napster taught the world how to protest market inefficiencies from central companies. As of 2001, no concession had been made by the record labels to the protests known as Napster, LimeWire and its many derivatives, and soon, BitTorrent. The Business Software Alliance estimated that the worldwide software piracy rate was 40%, costing the music industry $10.97 billion. In lost revenues. Noticing that these protests were growing, the record labels sought to get their act together, the first step on their way to conceding. Record labels' answer to Napster still has artists feeling bypassed, by Neil Strauss, February 18, 2002. Attempt number one, press play. In December of 2001, Universal and Sony Music partnered to come up with Press Play. Quote, "We are now spending tens of millions of dollars to help launch Press Play in the hope that a legitimate response to the illegitimate services will provide an attractive alternative to consumers. This is truly a time for artists and record companies to be working together." End quote. Rand Hoffman, head of business affairs for multiple record labels. Why it was rejected? Among Press Play's tone-deaf problems were, not every song was available for streaming, and among those that were, not all could be downloaded, and you couldn't burn more than two tracks from the same artist. Because of serious issues with how they compensated artists, Press Play did not have access to the breadth of artists that decentralized applications did. One manager computed that an artist would need four of their songs downloaded for that artist to earn one penny. Attempt number two, MusicNet. Why it was rejected? MusicNet costs $10 per month for 100 streamed songs and 100 downloads. Each downloaded audio file expired after only 30 days. Each time you listened to a song, it counted against your stream total. This was a far cry from the flexibility that LimeWire and BitTorrent provided. Both companies had only a segment of popular artists with completely incompatible ways to listen to that music. To compete with the decentralized options, the music executives would need to do more. Quote, "Neither Press Play nor MusicNet's paltry music selections could compete against the virtual feast available through illicit means," end quote. PCWorld.com, 2006. The concessions trickle in. Quote, "I came up with 99 cents per track download. Steve Jobs liked it. A lot of others didn't like it. But at that time, there was nothing going on except free downloads," end quote. Paul Vidich, VP of Warner Music Group. In 2003, Apple launched the iTunes Music Store. Key to its value proposition was that it included the distribution rights for the most popular copyrighted songs on the market, in one single location. Quote, "The attraction of Napster was not just that it was free, but more importantly, it gave people a way to connect with pretty much any piece of music," he continues. "What Steve was doing with iTunes was to replicate that type of experience, a vast catalog available on a singles basis with a convenient interface. It had to be easier than Napster. End quote. A quote from Paul Vidich, VP of Warner Music Group, iTunes would be the first legal all-in-one competitor to Napster. The record labels came to the negotiating table with Jobs because their half-baked concessions had not worked. What ensued were famously intense negotiations, leading to concessions the record industry had never before made, namely around pricing and digital rights management. Quote, with a series of dramatic presentations showcasing the iTunes interface, Jobs won over Warner executives, then moved on to the other big labels, including Universal and Sony. He allowed some digital rights management, a key point for the labels, although it wasn't as strict as they would have preferred. They allowed him to price every song for 99 cents. End quote. We believe that 80% of the people stealing stuff don't want to be. There's just no legal alternative. So we said, let's create a legal alternative to this. Steve Jobs, 2003. You did not rent to own the music you purchased for 99 cents. You owned it, and the iTunes Store interface and its ease of integration with products like the iPod made it friendlier than any decentralized application. To this effect, the iTunes Music Store sold over 1 million songs in its first week and had over 70 million purchases its first year. The iTunes concession by record labels was a resounding success as money started flowing into the iTunes ecosystem. As the years went on, users became less interested in owning an MP3 than being able to stream any song on demand, specifically in a freemium model. The Spotify concession. Headline: Music piracy fallen dramatically over the last 5 years thanks to streaming services such as Spotify and Tidal, survey reveals. Jack Shepard, August 2, 2018. Spotify's co-founder Daniel Ek used the exact same language to describe Spotify's value proposition that Steve Jobs did when announcing iTunes. Just as Jobs, several years earlier, Ek lamented that legal options did not provide a, quote, better experience than privacy. Quote, at the time, you could only buy DRM music tracks for 99 cents, he said in his slight Swedish accent, referring to digital rights management, the system of restrictions used by iTunes and other digital retailers. At the same time, I could steal a file which cost zero, had no restrictions whatsoever, and had better sound quality, he said. The illegal pirated product was actually better than the one you purchased. So our view is, how do we create a better product than privacy? End quote. Though Spotify launched in Europe in 2008, it took until 2011 for the service to become available in the US. Digital music services like Spotify needed to negotiate rights with each record label and copyright holder, unlike radio, which could pay one upfront fee. Though the record labels in the US made licensing deals with similar offerings, Rhapsody and MySpace Music, they were reluctant to make any such deal with Spotify due to its freemium model. Spotify was the only proposed music streaming service where users did not have to pay up front. Advertising would drive revenues from free users, a model that record labels resisted. Quote, free streaming services are clearly not net positive for the industry, and as far as Warner Music is concerned, it will not be licensed. The freemium model strategy is not the kind of approach to business that we will be supporting in the future. End quote. Edgar Bronfman, Warner Music CEO, 2010. The negotiations between Spotify and record labels once again came down to the pressure of the protests and how to end them. Quote, Ek concedes that Spotify does not generate record labels as much cash as paid-for downloads, but says without it, the labels would be losing even more to pirates. End quote. Daniel Ek profile, Spotify will be worth tens of billions. The Telegraph, 2010. Convincing them about their freemium model, which gave record labels less control than ever, was the only way to do so. Effects of the Spotify concession. Headline: internet piracy falls to record lows amid the rise of Spotify and Netflix. The Telegraph, 2016. Once the record labels conceded to the protest by accepting Spotify's freemium model, the protest once again got pushed to the fringes of society. This is largely because decentralized protocols have a worse user experience than centralized alternatives. Rather than communicating with a single computer, you have to interact with several around the world, some of which may not have the information you need. Quote, 40% of the respondents to the MPD survey who decreased their illegal file sharing said they did so because of access to legal streaming services like Pandora and Spotify, which are easier to use and don't present the threat of spyware or viruses, end quote. Victor Luckerson, Time, 2013. Movies, 2000 to 2011. Quote, the music industry lost a lot of money when it dithered over this transition to user-friendly content, and now the movie business seems to be making the same mistake. It could be raking in a lot of cash. Until it works out a plan to do so, there's always BitTorrent. End quote. Farhad Manjoo, Slate, 2009. The problem, from 2000 to 2011. Popular movies had an 11-year lifespan before becoming available for digital, subscription-based streaming. The protest, BitTorrent for downloading movies. The concessions, Starz licensing deal with Netflix for premiere content in 2008. Floodgates opening to more premium channels, agreeing to licensing with Netflix and future competitors. The same protest, concession, protest ends pattern emerged in the movie industry. The concession was Netflix's stream all you want subscription model that studios resisted. To understand the concession, it's helpful to understand the life cycle of rights around Hollywood movies. In this windowing system, a movie starts in theaters, hits DVDs after a few months, becomes available for pay-per-view, goes to premium channels with a roughly 15-month exclusive rights period, then goes to ad-driven broadcasters and networks like Fox and NBC. Finally, after 11 years, the movie enters a library phase in which places like Netflix can stream it. This brutal life cycle made Netflix, at best, a collection bin for outdated movies. To break this mold, Netflix sought to inject itself into an earlier phase of the life cycle. Rather than wait 11 years, Netflix would negotiate deals with the premium channels to receive the licensing rights at the same time as cable networks did. To this effect, Netflix struck a deal with Starz Entertainment in 2008 to legally stream premiere titles like Spider-Man 3 and Superbad. This deal cost Netflix only $25 million a year until 2012 when it would expire, and swelled Netflix's user numbers from 9 to 25 million during that time frame. Starz found it cannibalized their own sales. In fact, analysts estimated Starz should have priced the deal at $300 million. Though ill-advised for Starz, these premium titles' availability on Netflix was very much the concession that the rampant BitTorrent protest for movies sought. A subscription model for unbounded streaming of premium content. As evidence, in May of 2011, when the Starz agreement was in place, Netflix overtook BitTorrent in aggregate broadband traffic from North America. More bodies of research show that when premium content was available on Netflix, there was a subsequent drop in BitTorrent downloads for that title. Their exploding user numbers made premium channels reluctantly come to the table to offer similar licensing deals. Lionsgate agreed to license its Mad Men series to Netflix in 2011, and CBS its Frasier, Medium, and Cheers shows as well. Quote, the only fights now are over money, as firms like Netflix get more subscribers and studios get more desperate as traditional revenue channels dry up. We'll see more deals to get better titles online. End quote. Farhad Manjoo, Slate, 2011. What does this mean for cryptocurrencies? Cryptocurrencies are a decentralization play like any other. They are a protest seeking a concession. Tweet by Brandon Arvanagi. Decentralization has never been an end state. Historically, it's a vessel to achieving a concession. The Decentralization Playbook. Protest a market inefficiency. Win that protest via a major concession. Disappear back to the fringes of society. The killer concessions that might end much of the cryptocurrency protests include 1. Borderless transacting without intermediaries. 2. Ease of access to banking and capital, creating a private-public key pair rather than being beholden to a bank. 3. Legal digitized gambling. They would never include censorship resistance, anonymity in transactions. These last two points are historically what mainstream users care least about. Not only that, but they are the culprit for why decentralized protocols uniformly have such a bad user experience. Conceding to the mainstream demands behind the protest, while eliminating the friction, are exactly why Spotify and Netflix beat out BitTorrent. For mainstream users, it's a win-win. What are the killer concessions for cryptocurrencies? The profile of the killer concession I outline above, which concedes to the biggest drivers of the protests, are likely 1. A trusted global coin like Libra, where nations cooperate to regulate a currency spanning borders. 2. Nations digitizing their sovereign currencies on an interoperable or single blockchain, so people can easily transact with each currency. A programmable global coin, or nations digitizing their sovereign currencies, would allow transacting with no intermediaries, ease of access to banking, and programmable money and smart contracts for applications like gambling. These chains would be more centralized and thus not censorship resistant, but consequently would also provide a better user experience. If you want evidence of this concession model applying to cryptocurrencies, consider that China's president recently announced they will emphasize adoption of blockchain technology for China, stating it is necessary to implement the rule of law, and also calling for, quote, guidance and regulation. If China's proposal does not satisfy these global protests, say capital controls are even stricter in their proposed blockchain than the status quo, it will be another music net, and the protests will keep growing. However, in response to growing protests, every country will be forced to iterate on concessions until they finally arrive at a satisfactory response, like iTunes or Spotify. Isn't decentralization the point of cryptocurrencies? Many would argue that the entire point of cryptocurrencies is decentralization. Trustless assets with fixed supply caps. To them, centralized concessions could never quell the protests, because decentralization is the value proposition. Governments can arbitrarily print money, but cryptocurrencies cannot change their supply schedule unless the majority of their network agrees to do so. However, concessions could still adversely impact this seemingly untouchable property. First, the global coin concession would also support smart contracts, allowing every application that drives value to Ethereum, digital collectibles, lotteries, prediction markets, etc., to also be built there. While these assets will be on a more trusted chain, it will also be free of the user experience issues plaguing blockchains today. Cryptocurrencies that arouse interest from the promise of smart contracts will be reduced to their core value proposition, as a trustless store of value. When that happens, developers, companies, miners, and users who may have sought more from these blockchains may leave in favor of centralized alternatives. Second, the very need for an ironclad safe haven asset may decrease with the advent of a global coin, or if several countries digitize their native currencies. Venezuelans suffering from hyperinflation today may seem like the perfect use case for a safe haven asset. In reality, their problem is one of liquidity. They seek to store value in something more stable than the bolivar. Capital controls currently make that impossible. Quote, I keep all of my money in Bitcoin. Keeping it in bolivars would be financial suicide. I don't have a bank account abroad, and with Venezuela's currency controls, there's no easy way for me to use a conventional foreign currency like American dollars. End quote. Carlos Hernandez, Venezuelan economist, Bitcoin saved my family, The New York Times. In short, concessions could make the markets for currencies perfect. If the bolivar suffers, transactions may proceed in the digitized yuan, dollar, euro, global coin, or anything else. Liquid markets may lessen the need for fail-safes. There will likely still be demand for a trustless safe haven asset in this more liquid world. However, the killer concessions will still reverberate throughout the cryptocurrency industry as it exists today. At the very least, these concessions will eliminate all usage of projects where being completely trustless is not the primary demand driver. Everything else can and will be done better on a more trusting global coin, the same way Spotify is used over BitTorrent for music. This is not a doom and gloom scenario. When the killer concessions are inevitably made, we will be living in a world that, by definition, has less of a need for protest. All protests seek concessions, so even if some market caps decrease, cryptocurrencies will have spurred meaningful change, the same way Napster, LimeWire, and BitTorrent brought us iTunes and Spotify. Wrapping up. The concession for a global coin like Libra or digitized national currencies will not take place overnight. In fact, Libra will likely never see the light of day. Cryptocurrencies are so young that we are in the press play and music net days of concessions, and what Facebook is doing today is the equivalent of proposing Spotify to music executives in the year 2000. In a sense, the price of the token represents the health of the protest. When the protest ends, you would expect to see that health metric drop as well. This could be why the BitTorrent token is doing so poorly. It was created after the Spotify and Netflix concessions. Had this token been added pre-concession, we may have seen a different outcome. Bitcoin and Ether have a token to capture the momentum of their protest while it is alive and well. Time will tell if mainstream concessions have a similar effect. Napster caught the mainstream eye in 2000, and it took about 11 years for the Spotify concession to be made. Concessions around currencies require nations to cooperate, which is inherently more difficult than music and movie executives. If we assume a similar time schedule, we can expect the concessions I outlined above in the late 2020s. When that takes place, we will likely see the protests, the use of decentralization for money, die down. If you enjoyed this post, follow me on Twitter. I post there more frequently. A response I might hear, quote, "But money is different than music and movies. Money moves in two directions, whereas the incentive with files is just a download," end quote. Currency dynamics existed in BitTorrent well before any token was added. These dynamics incentivized transacting in both directions, receiving and sharing, just like cryptocurrencies today. As you would expect, these currencies fell out of favor once the right concessions were made. All right, and that was Brandon Arvanagy's, and he is at Gemini, by the way, cryptocurrency and analysis and security. I will link to this article on Medium. And I love this little walk through BitTorrent, Napster, and like all of these histories. I love talking about this concept because I grew up in this world and I saw all this happen. So I love kind of walking it back and seeing how this all plays out again and how it applies to what we've got today and what cryptocurrencies are actually doing and where they're similar and where they're different. So I really want to get into Guy's take on this. Let's go ahead and take a break real quick, hit our sponsor, and we'll jump back in and talk about this piece. All right. So I actually want to start this off with a caveat that I have to admit I didn't quite, I saw him alluding to it in the article. But I don't think it was like very clearly stated, which he actually did in our private conversation when I was asking him about whether or not I could read the article. And because I love this, like I said, I love this. And thank you to Brandon, by the way, for letting me read this so that we can talk about it, because I love these ideas. I've read a number of things about BitTorrent and the history of decentralized protocols. And I think there's so much rich history that if we look very, very closely and we really break down how these things played out, just like this with the killer concessions that really altered the nature and the use of some of these protocols, we can kind of see what the difference is between, there's just a lot of great lessons to be learned here. So his comment though, after, you know, we back and forth a little bit, he said, if it's not clear from the article, I think this is a bullish case for Bitcoin, where the demand driver actually is being a trustless store of value. It's also a bullish case for society, because everyone's better off for Netflix and Spotify existing. Much less bullish on the long-term prognosis of, quote, lifestyle brand applications on blockchains like Ethereum. If they grow large enough and the choice for the body they're protesting is concede or die, they always choose concede, end quote. Excited to listen. So that was his underlying argument, was that the real value proposition falls on, which was a quote actually in the article, that I don't think was quite emphasized, but was a very important crux of his argument, is that, quote, cryptocurrencies that arouse interest from the promise of smart contracts will be reduced to their core value proposition as a trustless store of value. When that happens, developers, companies, miners, and users who may have sought more from these blockchains may leave in favor of centralized alternatives, end quote. So basically, the underlying value proposition is the fact that it is trustless, and it's exactly that aspect of it, that it is independent and cannot be co-opted by any single institution, nation-state or otherwise, that will force those institutions, that will force a cooperation between them that was not possible beforehand. But I want to go through this kind of piece by piece and hit a couple of different aspects of how I think, not necessarily cryptocurrency in a broad sense, but Bitcoin as a technology, like the idea of an independent money, doesn't quite follow these rules, and that there's actually a better comparison than BitTorrent and Napster and those sorts of things that we can use for Bitcoin. Now, before we get into that, though, I just want to kind of talk about the nature of BitTorrent and some of the differences and the concessions as I saw them back in the day, because I think he's absolutely right, and this is a really fun exploration of that, is that what was happening was that the industry was refusing to actually shift to a new reality, that the dynamics of the actual market, of the content creation market, of the distribution market, had entirely shifted out from underneath them in a matter of a couple of years. And where the consumers were was a completely different world. And they refused to adjust. They refused to travel to this new world. And they were trying to attempt to reinstill all the limitations of the old world into this new space, into the new digital ecosystem, which obviously was never going to work. And the ease with which you could program or create a decentralized alternative to basically get around their resistance, their idiocy, I guess you could say, or their stubbornness, made it impossible for them to do anything about it. There's a quote that I always found it hilarious when I would read these back in the day. I kept up with like the RIAA and the MPAA like fights and stuff. I used to read. I still do on occasion, but I used to read Torrent Freak a lot, torrentfreak.com, because they just keep up with news about all of this stuff. Like, I actually followed this pretty closely before I found Bitcoin, and this was a fascinating topic for me always. But he's got a quote here of the, quote, Business Software Alliance estimated that the worldwide software piracy rate was 40%, costing the music industry $10.97 billion in lost revenues, end quote. Now, there is definitely a degree of truth to this, but they always greatly overestimated the effects that these things had, because what they would do is they would just take blanket download numbers and then apply whatever their current price tag was to it and say, this is how much money we lost. And this was always the argument in court, too, that when they were attacking, because they had to go after individual people. So, like, people who shared a lot or seated on the networks would get brought into court and then fined for hundreds of thousands. They would attempt to. Luckily, most of it failed. But some people got Ross Ulbricht. You know, they got made examples of and lives destroyed over sharing stuff on their computer, which is ridiculous. But they would claim, you know, millions and millions of dollars in losses because they shared it with 100 people, and then those 100 people shared it with 1,000 people, et cetera, et cetera. They would try to hit them for the whole thing. And what mostly happened with these lawsuits was that people would settle for like $1,000, $2,000 fine or something. Like, essentially, they would be like, we will drop the case if you pay $2,000 right now. If not, you're looking at 50 years in prison and $20 million in fines and blah, 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 like all this crap. So most of the time, just sending a letter to the house scared the shit out of everybody and just got the pay. They just got the $2,000 check or whatever it was. But why are these estimates a little bit ridiculous? What makes them a bit bogus? Even though this isn't really to Brandon's argument or anything, I just always found this funny, was that the major problem was that the cost barrier is exactly what altered the nature of the spread of the media. For instance, like, an article behind a paywall will spread at just a fraction at the rate of an article that is free, like when you're talking about around, like, sending around on social media. So it's a false equivalency to say that just because someone downloaded it for free, that they would have gone through the paywall, or that, like in a songs instance, they would have gone to the store and bought it, but they pirated it instead. When really the whole point was that when the nature of it is that it's free, that it might have been the only reason they even listened to the song. And I can basically give my own experience here. Super bad OPSEC. I used to pirate stuff all the time. I was a huge movie buff. I still am a big movie buff, but anything that I was interested in seeing that, like, I was excited about, I went to the theater, period. My dad and my brother and I were huge, huge movie buffs, and so we bought movies like crazy. We still have a DVD and Blu-ray collection of many thousands of movies. It straight up takes the entire walls of a theater above our garage back home. But I still downloaded movies. So why, right? Like, I literally had access to all of them. There were two reasons. One, I would download the things that I wasn't going to watch otherwise. I would casually watch movies that I just wasn't sure about, didn't seem that interesting, but, you know, maybe it had a director I'd liked something before by, like, an actor or actress or something that I thought, like, was really good, and, you know, so I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, or some interesting element to the storyline that I was like, I'll just check this out for 15 minutes and see if it's any good. Most of them were crap, you know, I would probably say it's like a 20% ratio of, like, finding things that were actually decent in a subset of movies that I just never would have seen otherwise. But that was impossible in any other context. Like, I can't just not pay for a movie and watch the first 15 minutes of it just to see if I get sucked in. So I still downloaded a lot of movies back then. Second reason is I downloaded stuff I already owned. Because I was increasingly watching stuff on the computer and mobile devices. Like, I was sucked into computers at a very early age, so I consumed my media very differently than just physical media. Like, as soon as it was in any sort of digital format, I was like, this is the way that I want to have it. Just like they talked about, the amount that you could do with it, the breadth of control that I had over it. Like, DVDs were really cumbersome and a pointless annoyance when you're talking about trying to watch something on a laptop or on a mobile device or on one of those, like, little media players or something. Like, if I was going to take my laptop and watch a movie somewhere, I was going to bring 100 DVDs of all the movies that I might watch, it'd fill up my whole suitcase. But I had a 500 gigabyte hard drive and an internet connection. What's my alternative? So the few options that were available for downloading, like iTunes really being one of the only ones that really started that out before, you know, Netflix got off the ground, they were a nightmare of incompatibility. I'm a filmmaker, or at least I called myself and identified that way for a long time before I got sucked into Bitcoin and it kind of took over my life. But I want to support the artist. I want to support the creators of the content. Like, if I'm a content creator myself, I've always wanted to get into film at some point. I had no desire to prevent them from getting paid for their work. Just like the quote he said, I think it was from, was it Daniel Ek or something? I think it was Steve Jobs, is that most people didn't want to be pirating it. And I didn't. I was one of those people. I would rather have found a really convenient and easy way to get it in a digital format, just because that's how I consumed the media. But buying digital copies of these things was awful. You couldn't use it anywhere. And it was still years after it was available that it wasn't highly, highly limited just because of the technology, just because of what you actually could get Netflix on. It wasn't really until like Blu-ray players allowed you to, like, had Netflix and like some of these streaming services and stuff already installed, or now TVs have these things already installed and the, you know, smart players and all that stuff became ubiquitous and incredibly cheap, that option really existed. Like, I remember there was a time when iTunes was really getting into providing all of this stuff for the customers, and I was like, oh man, there's all the movies are up here. I can literally just buy them up here and have a digital copy that's higher quality than what I would have torrented, that has all the, gives me a pretty interface with like organizing it and the posters and all this stuff. So yeah, I'll support the artist. I'll support the director. I'll support the movie and buy it on iTunes. So I went on like a little spree, like one of the first times that I did this. I bought like 5 or 6 movies or something and a season of some show. I can't remember what it was. It was like, I feel like it was Archer, but that might have been a little bit later. Maybe it was like South Park or something. I can't remember what it was, but it was something like that. And because they were building a really good catalog. But after I bought all of this stuff, I realized I couldn't copy it to any of my other devices. Like, my media player couldn't download iTunes. Like, so I couldn't watch. I had like one of those little, what was it? What was the brand? I can't remember. Western Digital. They had like a little Western Digital Media Player Plus or something like that. And it had like a 500 gigabyte or terabyte hard drive or something crazy. And so I could put movies on it and I could carry it around with me. It was my replacement for DVD players. But I couldn't put iTunes on it. So I couldn't watch anything. So I had just bought all of these movies and the season of the show. And the only thing that I could watch it on was my desktop computer. I thought I was going to get a file that I could just put on my other devices. Nope. I literally could not watch it on anything. So what did I do? I repirated all of the stuff that I had just bought so I could watch it. I never watched the files that I purchased. So anyway, that was just kind of my perspective during those days of actually trying to let that concession happen. Like, I did not want to be just a pirate all the time for no reason. I like to support the content. But when the industry doesn't give you an option, it's hard not to do it. When, like, just like he said, there's a couple of great quotes in this that he pulled from headlines and articles and stuff of just, it was a pain in the ass. And it just was. It was stupid for me to buy it on iTunes for any other reason other than just me being charitable and altruistic. That was the only reason. There's no use whatsoever in actually having the file on that platform. At least at the time. Now that all the software and the platforms are ubiquitous and I got, like, you know, my Apple TV and all that stuff, now it's great because the platform itself is on all of my devices and the inner work, like, all of the stuff is compatible. They've developed standards. Everybody's figured out their digital rights management bullshit and sorted out all the nonsense. So now that's just not an issue. We live in a much freer market, I guess you could say, in what you can do with your content. There's still a lot of limitations, obviously, But the fact that it's so readily available in pretty much any form that you could want makes it largely pointless to go pirate stuff. I just almost always have access to it somewhere else, some other way. Now, let's talk about cryptocurrencies and decentralized exchanges and all of this stuff. I think there is a lot to say for this argument in the sense of if some centralized institution conceded a lot of those different, like essentially the concessions of different nations and jurisdictions, and also concessions given from some of the largest world financial institutions in what sort of freedoms people actually have, like what level of control they have over their assets and what they can do with them, I think absolutely would kill a lot of the value of those, anything that's reliant on, you know, a decentralized exchange for the value of its token, or reliant on a DeFi or whatever. Like those are things that inherently have counterparty risk. So I don't think there's a clear and simple way to completely decentralize them. And the centralized, the better, more free centralized alternative, like the more open and conceded centralized alternative, is going to put them out of the water, because nobody's going to go through the headache of decentralization without a clear benefit or a clear value proposition that brings it to them. So if you're playing jurisdictional arbitrage, if you're playing regulatory arbitrage, as soon as that regulation concedes to the fact that that arbitrage is not going anywhere, that you can easily move money from country A to country B, if they concede and change the regulation, or they change the capital controls to basically null and void the need for it, well, then you've got a network that's not worth anything. Particularly if there's no underlying security in the actual monetary aspect of the network. If all you're doing is leaning on the whole smart contract functionality, if all you're relying on is this one single utility or dominant use case that is just about creating a product that gets around some typical problem or inefficiency in the legacy system, there might not be any value to stand on when the legacy system admits defeat, which it inevitably will. Like I said in the episode with Daniel Prince, I think Bitcoin is going to be that elephant in the room. Every time the central bank committees and the central banking boards and governments all get together and they start talking about monetary policy, Bitcoin is going to be the elephant in the room that says, we have a very strict limit, or we have a fence around what we can actually accomplish because of the existence of this tool. Just like BitTorrent forced the hands of all of these large corporate entities that thought they dominated the market, and in just a couple of years had no leg to stand on. They were just, they were literally on the path to death if they did not do something to concede the ridiculous inefficiencies and the assumptions they were trying to force onto a digital world that was not a problem anymore. As an example, he's got a quote from this of when we're talking about the digital rights management and like how this played out in the music industry, was, quote, "What ensued were famously intense negotiations leading to concessions the record industry had never before made, namely around pricing and digital rights management," end quote. So what's funny is that the most resistance they found were in the digital rights management area. And not only that, that's still the place where there is the most limitation in what you can do or how much control you have over it. But that's where like things like Spotify and Netflix actually benefit from just the convenience, the simplicity, and the reliability of those platforms, that you don't need to give much control to the user as long as you allow them to access it anywhere. And now that the infrastructure exists to make that so easy, it's not something where people even want to, like, I don't want a huge database of music now. Like, I used to have gigs and gigs of music. Like, 10 gigs of like a music library. And now I'm just like, delete all that crap. Why do I want that on my computer? I'll use the space for something else. I have Spotify and Pandora. I just listen to stuff when I want to listen to it. And YouTube, for crying out loud. But digital rights management was where they most desperately needed to concede their control, even though it's the part where they most wanted to keep control. It was easier for them to concede the pricing than it was to concede the digital rights management. But they wanted physical limitations on digital media. It just wasn't possible. It was the key problem that they were not allowing to ease on. You know, they wanted to reverse 2 decades of technology. It just wasn't going to happen. The industry had changed. The way people consumed media had changed. The platforms had changed. The cost of distribution had changed. The creation process had changed. The reach of the artist outside, specifically of the record labels, had changed. You didn't need any giant manufacturing plant anymore to produce billions of plastic discs and then ship them in trucks all around the globe. You just needed a computer, a file, and an internet connection. The testament was that people were distributing the content for free. Like, they were just seeding online because it literally costs nothing to just share it with someone else. And the people who were originally, the record labels and stuff that were originally paying or charging a physical media price for this distribution, wanted to extend that price into this new medium where someone could compete with them at zero cost. Somebody who just had the file could just offer it up to the whole world for free. That was never sustainable. They wanted to keep their giant label, their legal structure, all the admins that were being paid these extra exorbitant fees, the manufacturing cuts, the percent take of the manufacturer. They wanted all of this control and all of these things over distribution that they had in the past. It just wasn't the case anymore. You can't take a 1980s music prices, controls, and distribution problems and think that you're going to recreate them on the internet. It was literally the perfect example of an adapt or die scenario. So, let's get to the good stuff. Why don't I think Bitcoin is susceptible to this? What's the difference between the decentralization of the underlying money and then the supposed features or market services that we can provide with that money? That's what I think the difference is. It's the difference between the money and the services. BitTorrent, Napster, these were service levels. This was service level decentralization. This is where the corporate world was not adjusting to the new realities of the digital world. But here's the thing. What was it that caused the difference in the conditions? What was it that caused the real world, the digital world, to actually come into being? How could BitTorrent be decentralized? How could Napster be decentralized? It was all because of TCP/IP. There was no concession that could have prevented TCP/IP success. This was a fundamentally different innovation in decentralization than something like BitTorrent. AT&T could do nothing to appease the internet protocols and prevent their growth, even though they had a veritable monopoly on the communication infrastructure of this country. TCP/IP, the original internet protocol, is what made BitTorrent able to push to force the hands of and Napster and now even Tor and like things like this to force the hands of the corporate world to adjust to this new reality. It was all dependent on the permissionless decentralized nature of the internet itself. Those were stage two problems. Those were layer two issues and services and features. But the underlying problem of communication in and of itself required a standard, required a global networking standard in order to actually facilitate the move into a completely different ecosystem. It became the foundation of all of these other things to be possible. Bitcoin is far more akin to TCP/IP, and I think its network effects and the need for its protocol are actually stronger because money is a far more potent and exclusive language than even a communication standard is. And I'll explain that in just a second. But I do want to just hit that quote again, that cryptocurrencies that arouse interest from the promise of smart contracts will be reduced to their core value proposition as a trustless store of value. When that happens, developers, companies, miners, and users who may have sought more from these blockchains may leave in favor of centralized alternatives. So what he's getting at here is that the underlying value proposition is an independent, trustless store of value. But part of that, I think, is that's almost kind of the second. That's almost a derivative value, because what's really going on here is very similar to what TCP/IP enabled, is that it's creating a standard by which a standard for value measurement, which is a store of value, but it's a standard for value communication that allows us to even cooperate and create an ecosystem for services and features and companies around the communication of that value. So just like TCP/IP was necessary in order to make an entirely new set of possibilities just in the nature of communication, social media, communicating video and music over the same medium, to create permissionless networks that push all of the innovation to the edge, TCP/IP was the prerequisite to actually creating a global cooperative market. The limitations and the barriers to a global communications system were incredibly great before TCP/IP came along. And what that did is it enabled something that wasn't even possible before. That is what Bitcoin does. BitTorrent didn't enable something that was previously impossible. It simply provided something that the centralized companies refused to provide. But the user experience was certainly possible because we basically now have it. And it's pushed BitTorrent sort of to the fringe. It's BitTorrent is no longer in its heyday. And just like that, there's a lot of things in these supposedly decentralized applications, in these decentralized exchanges and all of these supposed great decentralized features that can be provided by a centralized alternative that adapts its rules, adapts its environment in order to accommodate it. But Bitcoin does something, the underlying money, having an independent global standard that doesn't even know that these jurisdictions exist, is a prerequisite for all of those arbitrage opportunities to even be implemented at all. So in this analogy, Bitcoin is TCP/IP. Napster, Nutella, and BitTorrent are the financial services in the Bitcoin market, in the cryptocurrency market. It's that it's the exchanges that won't allow users from country A, B, and C, so people use local Bitcoins. They use the BISC network, or they use DeFi and microloan platforms, etc., because those corporate giants have KYC AML and don't allow loans under certain amounts because these arbitrary regulations about characteristics in the old financial system that don't exist in this new dynamic, in this new crypto economy that's being born from this technology. All of those things can be conceded. All of those things can be conceded by the regulatory system. They can be conceded by national jurisdictions. They can be conceded by corporate giants. But only if there is a decentralized, censorship-resistant standard for communicating value, an underlying protocol that can secure those sorts of services as a form of protest, aka Bitcoin. And there's last thing is that there's one other major element that's different about money, that does not apply to the media protest, to just an industry of like content creation in general, with movies, music, all that sort of stuff, when they wouldn't change over to the realities of our new digital world. Media isn't mutually exclusive. platforms like that are not mutually exclusive. You don't have to pick one or the other. Just like in my example in my history, I bought them on iTunes and pirated them so that I could get the full control over it. I can have an account on MySpace and Facebook. I can have Netflix, Hulu, Disney Plus, Apple TV Plus, all of those at the same time. BitTorrent was additive. Napster was additive. It was something that would work in conjunction with the alternatives. Value does not have that characteristic. The only way to get the utility, to get the freedom and capacity that a value technology or an asset provides is at the explicit exclusion of the alternatives. I can't hold $1 of value in Bitcoin and Ethereum at the same time, and the dollar at the same time. It is always in one or the other. Value can exist in one place. This is also why the network effects, the economics of money, so strongly pushes toward one medium, because the very problem that money solves can only be solved as one money. It's only the entire existence of money as an asset, as a good in the economy, is because it's a standard. It's not money if you don't share it with other people. It doesn't provide the value of a money. It doesn't give the efficiencies in the market of money unless it's being shared among everyone. So even if we're using a derivative currency, even if we're using a national currency, and regulations have conceded, central banks have conceded to enact a strong monetary policy, it will only be because you can easily translate those currencies to Bitcoin, to some sort of global standard. Otherwise, the efficiencies would be too great. You'd be paying fees for something that you didn't need to pay fees for. Why translate from one currency to another when there is a stronger currency that is more widely accepted, that is more liquid? It's like learning to speak the Elvish language when everybody speaks English. Why? Yeah, maybe a couple of nerds will do it, but it completely defeats the purpose of what a language is there to do. That is why I don't think Bitcoin is the same mechanism, and that the killer concessions are things that altcoins have to worry about. That things with much less sound monetary policies that are not trying to be the default fundamental value communication protocol of the globe, if that's not the goal, if they're relying on some feature, if they're relying on some service that they provide because, you know, some jurisdictions being, you know, a pain in the ass about allowing it, then they can be conceded and pushed to non-existence. And of course, if they're centralized, they can just be shut down. You know, no concessions have to be made if you have an admin key to your DeFi, or if you've got a centralized institution that decides everything that goes on with your protocol, and there's not really anything anybody can do to contest that. If you're IOTA and you can just pause your platform, what possible, which jurisdiction is going to allow you to do that when there's such an easy button to just shut you down? The underlying value proposition of a money is a socially scalable, independent mechanism, a language to communicate value between disparate jurisdictions, specifically between governments that can't cooperate in any other way, societies that have huge cultural barriers, that don't have common ground to lean on. So just like there was nothing AT&T could do to concede to the existence of TCP/IP and prevent it from becoming a global standard, there is nothing that central banks and governments can do to concede ground to Bitcoin and prevent it from becoming a global monetary standard. At least that's my assessment. That's Guy's take, if you will. All right, we'll close this out. Holy crap, 35 minutes. Good rant, guys, good rant. All right, I am out. Another thank you to Brandon Arvanagi. I hope I'm saying your name right, by the way. I super apologize if I'm butchering that. Do not forget, I'll put the link in the show notes to the article so you can drop some applause on it. And of course, I will link to his Twitter account and tag him and everything so that you can follow him on Twitter. Also, one last thing, I read that he was like with Gemini on the Medium page, but I think that was like outdated because on his Twitter page it said he's previously with Gemini and now with Layer One. Layer One's like they set up like mining factories and stuff like that. They all deal with like Bitcoin and cryptocurrency mining. But with that, don't forget to check him out and drop some applause on the Medium page. I am out today. Thank you guys so much for listening. This is the Crypto Economy with Guy Swan, bringing all the best writing in Bitcoin, all the best research, all the exploration and the development, all the amazing things that are building out the crypto economy. I bring it to you in audio and we explore it together and talk about where this is going to take us and what this future might look like and what we can learn from the past. And I really appreciated this article. Always fun to go down the BitTorrent and past decentralization rabbit hole to talk about what the future might have in store for us. Thank you so much for listening. Just a shout out today to my patrons. I've had a number of new people join my Patreon recently and or donate by Lightning and jump into the Crypto Economy Telegram crew and by Bitcoin. Holy crap, like huge donations recently. Sovereign Financial, which I think is like Sovereign Finan or Finance or something. I'll actually tag them in the post as well. Gave a big donation and I could not be more thankful. Thank you so much to all my patrons, to everybody who supports this show and have also tweeted out to help me find a sponsor. That's a huge help too. Thank you everybody who's done that. I love you all. I will be back here tomorrow with another episode. Don't miss it. Subscribe to the show. I am at The Crypto Economy on Twitter and thecryptoeconomy.com at the website if you want to dig through the huge catalog of stuff we've done in the past. And until next time, take it easy, guys.